From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. And you're listening to the song Swaying Trees by Takanobu, performed by a pair of classically trained musicians based in Atlanta. Might sound vaguely familiar since Takanobu is frequently used on NPR shows and the Invisibilia podcast. 2019 is shaping up to be a big year for composer Nick Takanobu Ogawa and Catherine Cook, who performed together as Takanobu, with an album coming out on May 24th and an upcoming tour with Kishibashi. But before all of that, they're joining me in the studio. Welcome to you both.
Thanks. Hi, thanks for having us.
So, Nick, I'm going to start with you. Takanobu means iron will in Japanese. Yep. It's also your middle name. So why use this as your nom de musique?
Well, it seemed like a better option than the Nick Ogawa band, which I thought would be pretty lame to use. And it's convenient as, an all-encompassing band and solo name. So I use it when I play with other people in the past. Now it's me and Catherine, but I've also used it when it was just me solo.
And Iron Will, that's forceful. That's an evocative name.
Yeah, that's kind of a loose translation of the kanji, which are like self-belief, kind of. But the name comes from an amalgamation of the kanji in my dad and grandfather's names.
Well, you started writing and performing as Takanobu. This was back in 2007. Recorded your first album, Introduction, completely on your own, but did get some help to fund its release from a singer-songwriter competition in New York. What happened there?
Yeah, so it was a national competition called the Williamsburg Live Singer-Songwriter Competition, and I think I applied at a minute to midnight on the deadline of
just
of
like
application.
A true artist.
Yeah. But it was several rounds of live performance. I think there was like several thousand entries, and then the final night was 9 finalists, and I won and got some prize money and used that to fund my album.
Yeah, and there was another competitor there that year, a woman named Lizzie Grant, who became...
Lana Del Rey.
Lana Del Rey.
Yep.
So did you two meet during the competition?
Yeah, she reached out to me over MySpace, actually.
Those were the days.
Yeah, so that kind of dates things a bit. But I recorded on some of her early stuff back then. And then she went on to become... super famous. So.
Well, you won the competition.
Yeah, I won the competition. So, it's coming.
Catherine, how about for you? You were formerly trained in an academic sense, undergrad and master's in violin performance. Where were you around this time, 2007?
2007, I was still in high school.
Okay.
But yeah, playing violin. And
how did you guys start playing together?
When I moved to East Atlanta, we started working for the same dog walking company, actually. And then somebody there introduced us as two musicians, and it just so happened that Nick was looking for a violinist to play with in his band. So
this is all working along.
Yeah, exactly.
Coming together just perfectly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and Nick, you submitted that album to a little music company called Pandora.
Yep.
But not much happened, so you got a job then at a software company, right?
Yeah, down here. I was a marketing person in like a business phone company. It was pretty, pretty dry stuff.
But so that was in 2008 when you moved to
2008,
Atlanta.
Yeah, moved down here. And at my mom's suggestion, I had submitted my album to Pandora and nothing happened for a while. But then after 3 years or so, I started to notice an uptick in my iTunes downloads. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon it was a car payment. And then it was a rent payment, and I said goodbye to the corporate world.
Okay, so incrementally. Mm-hmm. So before that, had you thought, like, that's it, I gave it a shot? But...
kind of. I mean, I always wanted to keep playing music, but, it didn't seem realistic to make my living at it, especially living in New York previous to Atlanta. It was very cutthroat and felt like you had to be, at a level I couldn't attain to really be a professional musician there. So
especially if you have to have a day job.
Yeah, have a day job, do music, and, stay up until 2 in the morning to play, crappy gigs on the Lower East Side. So it was a nice move to Atlanta. I love the city, but it was really nice to be able to go full-time with music.
So meanwhile, Catherine, you're on track to be performing in symphonies. You're a freelancer, and you actually do perform with everyone from the Atlanta Opera to Michael Bublé, I understand. So was that your career trajectory or goal when you started?
Originally, in music school, I mean, you're kind of trained for that, just to take auditions and, you know, try and be in a symphony full time. But I don't know. It never quite fit my personality to commit to that fully. So as soon as I was out of music school, it seemed like I was always playing in a band or, you know, with, you know, playing different types of music other than just classical. So, it's just a little bit of everything now, which I love.
Well, let's hear a little bit more of the music that, Nick, you made when you started making money. You quit your job and wrote and recorded your second album in 2011. Here's the song Exposition from the album of the same name. So in this case, is this all you, you know, layering yourself on top of yourself?
Exactly. Multi-layered.
A one-man show.
Recording, yeah. One-man band kind of thing, which in live performance we accomplish with loop pedals, recording ourselves as we play that, you know, continues to loop and we can layer stuff over top.
Well, this sort of moves and progresses through a little bit of an emotional journey. I mean, what was going on for you mood-wise here?
Well, it was sort of my freedom anthem, being able to, you know, escape the workaday life that I was not really into myself, and be able to just do music full time, which is what I had always wanted to do.
This is you breaking off the old ball and chain.
Yeah, yeah.
That is Nick Ogawa, and Catherine Cook is also with us. They make up the Atlanta-based classical pop folk whatever group, Takanobu, and joining me in the studio. That is something. I went to the Big Ears Festival a couple months ago, and they were talking about, like, reporters were talking about how they report on this music, and they always feel like, you know, if something doesn't fit into a certain genre, they have to start with, well, it's not for everybody, or, you know, that there's a way that they have to kind of explain it. Do you find yourself explaining what you do?
Yeah. I mean, I find myself trying to avoid explaining it. I've fallen back on just referring to it as cinematic folk, which seems to be a convenient catch-all because the instrumentation is not straight up folk guitar, you know, classic instruments for folk, but it's not quite folk, you know, it's not quite, you know, movie soundtrack stuff either. We're singing and
it seems like no matter what label you apply to it, people will go to the extreme of that. So it's not quite folk either.
Yeah.
And but you have done some stuff for video creators, right?
Yeah. That's actually kind of where things have taken me. Started with, you know, more like web video type of things, but now getting into composing for indie feature films, which has been great. I did a documentary a couple years ago and a feature last year and working on a feature now. So it's really fun stuff to
do. So what is that process like? You're watching something and you're trying to create a mood.
You're trying to, you know, capture the unspoken emotional backstory to the actor's actions and the director's intentions. And, you know, documentary, it's a little bit different. It's a little bit easier, I would say. But with feature film stuff, it's actually kind of more fun to do.
But you talked about, you know, that your downloads started paying eventually for what you, the car payment, right?
Yeah,
the stuff
payment,
you want to. And this is a story that really could only happen in the digital age.
It's true.
You have fans, but how about, you know, downloads? Does that equal bookings if you say, hey, I'm Takanobu, I would love to play at your club.
Right.
Take a chance on me.
It's actually, that's the main kind of struggle, kind of, because the algorithms are so good at personalizing people's tastes that the listeners can find the music, but it's not very transparent to the booking agents. So we really haven't done that much touring. This summer is going to be more our bigger foray into touring, which has been, you know, exciting to try to plan, but also a struggle to get the gigs because because people don't know who we are.
The venues we have been to, even though that they're small, it seems like they're totally filled to capacity. And
well, yeah, I mean, the 50 person, you know.
Well, I know, but everybody there is going up to Nick and just saying, "Oh, I've been listening to your music for years. I've been waiting to see you live." It's pretty cool.
It does feel good. But yeah, and people, I find a lot of people say that they listened to the music when they were studying for something. It seems like a, like a concentration music type of thing.
It's a little, it's, you know, somewhat repetitive, but there's enough variety that you don't feel like you're listening to one of those white noise things.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
The waterfall things outside of the massage.
Yeah, hopefully a little more engaging than that.
Well, there's another backstory here, too, which is you two as a couple.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're now engaged.
Yeah.
Okay. So where did that happen?
Well, it happened out on the West Coast when we were on tour last fall. Yeah. But we started dating pretty soon after we started playing together. We'd been rehearsing for a show. And I just kind of caught feelings for Catherine and had to express that to her. And then, we played the show in Portland and we were heading up to Seattle, but we took a detour through Cannon Beach on the Oregon coast. Mm-hmm. And we went on a hike and I popped the question, knelt down in the mud.
So there's a kind of romance to, there's an alchemy in the relationship and in the music as
sure.
well.
Yeah.
So Catherine, though, you're still working under Takanobu. What are you bringing? What do you feel like you're bringing to this combination?
So much.
I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to answer, but I don't know. Just female vocals, which had been there only a little bit before. And I think... since I am classically trained, I think I can bring some sophistication to my parts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're going to keep calling this Takanobu, or?
I think so for now, yeah. I mean, Catherine's been a great addition to the sound. She has a, you know, beautiful, sweet voice and a really nice violin tone and great musical sensibility, too. It's a really nice compliment to what I would, you know. I mean, we do a lot of improvising stuff instrumentally. And Catherine is, you know, kind of a rare classically trained musician who's really comfortable with that kind of thing.
I think when we started out playing together, too, I was just doing what you wanted me to do. You know, like you were telling me, okay, here are the parts.
But as like a base, you know, framework.
Right, exactly. But I'm, you know, now I think we're working together as a team much more about how we want it to sound live and... you know, what direction we want it to go.
And my suspicion is that Catherine will be really good at songwriting when she gets more comfortable doing that. So I've been encouraging her to do that. Mm-hmm.
And lots of practice coming up with your tour with Kishibashi. I want to thank you both, Nick Ogawa and Catherine Cook, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Together, they are the Atlanta-based Takanobu. And we said we'd leave you with another song. This one is called Nobody Said. We are back with On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott. Most Americans say they know at least some of their neighbors, but admit they tend to interact less with those who don't belong to the same race, class, or political party. And that's according to the Pew Research Center. When Tanya Del Valle and her husband Pablo move into the fixer-upper next door to Frank and Virginia Butley's historic home, a series and saga of microaggressions ensues. These racial, generational, and economic tensions play out in Native Gardens, a play on stage this month at Lawrenceville's Aurora Theater. And two of the show stars join me now in the studio to tell us more about the production. Fedra Ramirez Olivares is Tanya Del Valle and in Native Gardens. Jones. Hello.
Hi.
And Carolyn Cook is Virginia Butley. She's been on Second Thought before. That's what happens with those Atlanta theater regulars.
Hello, Virginia.
Welcome back. So the Butleys are white, the Del Valles are Latinx, and the Butleys are older, nearing their end of their careers in engineering and the federal government. Del Valles are successful, but still in their early careers in academia, also expecting their first child. What else can you tell us about these characters?
You want to go, Phaedra?
Sure. Tania is from New Mexico. She she wasn't very well off growing up, and her whole family has lived there for generations. That's one of her big things to teach, I guess, her new neighbors is, you know, what it's like to have Mexican heritage, but to have always been in the U.S. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit about her background.
How about for Virginia and Frank?
Well, here's what's wonderful about the writing. Karen Zacharias, who wrote this play, has done this magnificent, cross-stitch of characters where everybody's connected and everybody's different. So one of the ways that my character, Virginia Butley, who goes by Ginny, is very much like Phaedra's character, Tania, is that she also grew up with very few things. She grew up in Buffalo, New York. She is from an immigrant family, whereas the person of Mexican heritage in the play is not. Mm-hmm. Her family has always lived in the same place. It's just that the place was first part of Mexico and then became part of America. So the individuals in the family never immigrated. It's the land that changed. And in the case of my character, Virginia, her family is Polish-American, so her parents immigrated or her grandparents immigrated to the United States. So, but both of them come from similar economic backgrounds, so they have that mm-hmm. in common. Mm-hmm. They have in common the fact of being female and being wives. Their differences are ethnic heritage, age is yeah, a huge difference between them. Yeah. And but educationally, they're very much alike also. My character is an engineer. She works at Lockheed Martin. She is very well respected in her field. Mm-hmm. And Phaedra's character is on the verge of earning her PhD
in anthropology.
Mm-hmm. So just fascinating connections and disconnections between these people, which is just so true to life.
Right. And some of the assumptions that they make about each other beginning quite early, even before they've met, Frank assumes that the Del Valles prefer red over white wine.
Right.
As he's deciding what to give them as a housewarming gift. So what other kind of assumptions are they making about each other?
Oh, I think there's so many assumptions going on about what it means to be an affluent white person, how... I guess, who is racist, who is not, what it means to be Republican, what it means to be a Democrat, right? Like all of these polarizing things that we have in our society today and what we associate with that. And I think the play does a really good job of sort of dispelling that and subverting that. And being
subverting is a great word because mm-hmm. I have to say... when I first started reading the play, it's really about gardens. It really is. The whole subject matter of the play are these backyards mm-hmm. that are side by side and that have a really ugly chain link fence separating them.
It's really
so that's a bad fence making for good neighbors bad neighbors.
That's right. Bad fences. Right. And the whole plot is driven on replacing that chain link fence with mm-hmm. with a beautiful wooden fence. So it becomes about borders, it becomes about fences, it becomes about property rights, it becomes about all of these things that resonate on a national level, but are very, very personal.
Interpersonal and just,
about
keeping and achieving the American dream.
Exactly. Exactly.
Embodied in the yards, which is so interesting. In fact, like your character, Virginia, or Ginny, rather.
Ginny, goes by Ginny.
A name that still rankles me, but nonetheless, is a straight shooter. She tells the Del Valles that how happy she is that Frank and they finally have real homeowners next door.
Yeah,
what does real homeowners mean?
Well, real homeowners means that she doesn't like there being rental property in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. And that they had lovely neighbors who were older and passed away, and a relative has been renting out the house next door to college students who leave beer cans in the yard and so on and so forth. And our set designers, Mariah and Isabel Curly Clay, have done a magnificent job of leaving trash in that backyard. And you can see why Virginia would be really, really happy to have people purchase a home, purchase the home and move in and start to fix it up. So she's thrilled to have people settle in. And there's another very exciting element, which is that Tanya Del Valle is pregnant. So Virginia is seeing the possibility of being able to babysit, and maybe her son hasn't married for reasons that become clear over the course of the play. And she's dying for grandchildren. You know, it's a really, really wonderful opportunity. When I first read the play, I started reading it and I was like, oh, cute, you know, little domestic squabbles about gardens. Okay, different gardening philosophies. One has these beautiful, you know, hydrangeas and azaleas and so on, and the other is going to put in native plants. Okay, funny, funny, ha ha. And then I'm turning another page and another page and another page, and the way this writer subverts the arguments and and gives them the kinds of twists and jabs, it becomes laugh out loud hilarious. Yes. Hilarious. And the audience really rolls with us, but they're thinking at the same time. So it's, I got to say, it is a tour de force.
So for Ginny, her husband, Frank, he loves his garden. He's part of his identity as a gardener. But Fred, your husband, Pablo, he's hustling to make partner at his firm, gets a little carried away and invites his firm over for a garden party at your fixer-upper, which is not quite fixed up at that point. How does Tanya react and what does that reveal?
Tanya is very much against this idea at first. You know, there's a lot going on for them too. Pablo is going through quite a bit of pressure at work to sort of fit in as the only foreign Latinx person. But Tanya as well is you know, she's studying for her. She's getting ready to defend her dissertation. She's like almost 8 months pregnant. So it's unpacking. It's all these things. And it's kind of, I think for Tanya, she feels that Pablo is trying too hard, right? That he doesn't need to prove who he is. And that if he just does a good job, you know, they'll accept him. He's just a new guy. And it takes her a little bit longer to see the importance of really having to prove yourself in the workplace when you have this immigrant background that she hasn't really had to go through.
I wondered also, you know, because she comes from a humble place, the idea of showing a home that's less than perfect, you know, what like what the insides versus the outsides is there?
Sure. I think she has not necessarily ideas of what perfect is, but maybe she likes to show what her philosophies are and for that to be clear, especially through her like native garden and all of that. So yeah, there's definitely that level of like, you know, I want to have a settled home and like something that represents who we are. To these outside, you know, I guess spectators.
That's Fedra Ramirez Olivares, and Carolyn Cook is also with me. They're sharing the stage this month at Lawrenceville's Aurora Theater in the play Native Gardens, which is an exploration of the relationship between neighbors and the politics of ownership and race and class and how we see the natural and man-made world, which is something that you mentioned, Carolyn, that this is very much about like gardening philosophies on some level.
It is.
And Tanya, she grew up around gardens. Her grandparents owned a farm. She's planning a native garden in their backyard. So how does her vision of nature differ from Frank's, for example?
Well, my husband Frank, who's played by Bart Hansard, a brilliant comic actor, well, a brilliant actor across the board, His garden is what you would call a traditional, quote unquote, garden that you might see in the South. So it's a lot of the things that we plant in our yards here that may have been brought into our environment but aren't necessarily native to our environment. So things like English ivy, you know, you see those signs when you're going along the interstate, English ivy kills trees. And it is true that we've brought in a number of plants that kind of break down the natural ecosystem here. And what Tanya is trying to do is restore that. What Frank is trying to do is win the Potomac Horticultural Society's gardening award. And that means going with these very showy, beautiful plants. That it is a remarkably beautiful garden.
I guess.
So, yeah. But it doesn't support biodiversity. And so that's an exciting sort of and hilarious challenge that each of these gardeners has for each other, while at the same time, Frank and Tanya share the love of gardening. And Jenny, who was the only female engineer in her division for 20 years, shares Pablo's ambition and need to prove herself. So that's another way where you discover that you have something in common with a neighbor that maybe you thought you had nothing in common with.
Well, and it's funny, too, because Tanya says, asked Virginia and Frank, didn't you hear the segment on NPR about native gardening?
Exactly.
You know, which does exist.
Well, and they say, sure. Of course we listen to NPR. We're old, not dead.
But this is part of the funny thing that, you know, what becomes central to this is about reclaiming what is rightfully their property. Right. And without giving too much away, you know, there's a point where Ginny says, they want to take our land, you know, kind of thing. But this illustrates the idea that new people, new Americans, or someone perceived as a new American is taking something away from those who are established. But this is interesting because it sets up not between, you know, the disempowered anti-immigrant Americans saying, you know, they're taking our jobs, but the others. They're the NPR listeners,
exactly.
The middle class. So what did these dynamics bring?
First of all, a great deal of humor as you sit on, you know, on the outside looking in and go, oh, I've met somebody like that. Oh, that hilarious person is me. But yeah, it creates a self-questioning, I think, very much. It takes a little while for the characters to realize that they're maybe letting things fly out of hand. and the playwright does take us to a hilarious conclusion. But it challenges, you know, Jenny at some point says, you can't do this. Why are you trying to do this party? Why are you trying to take our land? What are you trying to do? Phaedra's character, Tanya, says, you understand he has something to prove at the office. You know, this is really important. And Jenny does understand. So it's, you know, but at the same time, she wants to defend her set in her ways, way of life. So, yeah, it becomes about sharing. Welcome to kindergarten.
I think it's also a little bit about showing the complexities of what it is to be an immigrant and how we tend to separate these groups, you know, on the basis of race. And we sort of oversimplify that and are like, okay, I can recognize who has ownership, who has right, who doesn't. But I think through this, allegory, we get to see, okay, this is much more complicated than we think, you know.
Yeah. And each individual in these groups that we're generalizing about is a person.
Right.
And we need to get to know them as people.
Well, it's harder to do when you're not sitting there watching them in a play. And I think that's part of, well, actually, maybe that is part of what's going on here. Listeners can go see Native Gardens at Lawrenceville's Aurora Theater through June 2nd. And, you know, Lawrenceville is in Gwinnett County, which has seen rapid transformation in terms of demographics in recent years. Seems like there could be a lot of folks out there who don't look just like their neighbors. So what do you think, what do you hope that audiences will get when watching this production?
I hope that people will see themselves on stage and will recognize their flaws and will also maybe identify with the other side of like, oh, you know, that I've been there before. I felt that so what does that say about my position or, you know, my own privilege or about my lack of it, you know?
Yeah, and it goes both ways, too. I feel like everybody can see their own flaws on stage, but also their own strengths, mm-hmm. because there's beauty in each one of these characters. There's ways that each one of them is right. And, you know, if you walk in the door wanting to judge anybody in the play, you're going to walk away having changed your mind a little bit. Everybody yeah. in the play has... kindness and generosity in them. They have a point to make. They just need to consider life in, I guess, with eyes more wide open.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just 20 seconds. Wondering if this play changed the way that you see your relationship with your neighbors. Either of you?
I think so. I think it really brought out just the value of listening and conversation, you know, being compassionate and empathetic. And how that is probably the most powerful tool to depolarize and bring people together who may think have nothing in common.
I would second that and say laughter, laughter, laughter. It goes a long way in healing.
Yes. All right. Details on the play Native Gardens at gpbnews.org. And on GPB, by the way, Governor Brian Kemp is scheduled to sign the so-called heartbeat bill at 10 o'clock this morning. We're streaming it live on the GPB Facebook page or Political Rewind Twitter feed. And of course, listen for coverage of the issue during Political Rewind at 2 this afternoon and during All Things Considered later on. Well, listen for the hard knock life of wrestlers. After the break, I'm Virginia Prescott. We are back with On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott. Professional wrestling boomed when cable hit in the late 70s and early 80s. Shows like Georgia Championship Wrestling and Mid-South Wrestling planted dreams of glory in the heads and hearts of muscular Southern boys. Ted, the Million Dollar Man, DiBiase, Jimmy Superfly Snuka, and Billy Superstar Graham all had important matches in Georgia, and they are among dozens of stars who took hits outside of the ring. The documentary film 350 Days looks into the hard knock lives of professional wrestlers in what is known as the golden age of wrestling.
350 days a year is a wrestler on the road.
Maybe it's a sickness.
350 days a year.
A lot of physical pain, a lot of loneliness.
You have no home life whatsoever.
Piper and me riding down the road, doing 8 balls of cocaine.
I'm sure it broke up marriages.
And that last voice you heard was former pro wrestler J.J. Dillon. He was the NWA Macon Heavyweight Champion. He joins me now on the line from Delaware. J.J., hello.
Good morning, Virginia.
Good morning. And also with us, Darren Antola. He's creator and executive producer of 350 Days. He's joining me from NPR in New York. Hello there, Darren.
Good morning, Virginia. Thank you very much for having me on. Much appreciated.
Thanks for being here. JJ, we just heard a little bit from that documentary. More than a film to you, but your life. So what comes to mind when you hear 350 days?
Well, it immediately reminds me of what makes the world of professional wrestling unique as compared to anything else, whether it's basketball, baseball. When you look at all, racing, they're all seasonal. They have a season, and then they have a downtime. Mm. And professional wrestling is really 365 days out of the year, which makes it quite unique. And it was a big part of my life for well over half a century.
Well, it doesn't leave a lot of time for family and friends. Darren, you talked to nearly 80 wrestlers from the time. About half of those made it into the movie. One says, wrestling was one thing, living the life was another. Are there any stories about life on the road that stand out for you?
Oh, there's just so many of them. I don't even know where to begin, but I will say Greg Valentine had some really great stories, and J.J. Dillon had some really, really great stuff, and he says it captured our lives like no other documentary, so that really meant a lot to me. Mm. But to answer your question, superstar Billy Graham's story was pretty interesting. How this girl saved his life and his liver went bad, and it was just brings tears to your eyes.
Yeah, he got hepatitis C, maybe from being in the ring with this part of the theatrics was slitting their foreheads with blood, so blood would be running down, which is part of the whole story here about the theatrical and the performance aspect of this. And of course, not everybody in the biz becomes The Rock. We hear in the film that some wrestlers got paid only $30 a day, healthcare benefits non-existent. Here's million-dollar man Ted DiBiase.
I think about driving to Greenwood and Greenville, Mississippi, and wrestling in front of 100 people, and then getting in a car and driving 300 miles, and some of those nights not having enough money to even eat at McDonald's. We would go and buy a loaf of bread and, you know, bologna. We call it bologna blowouts. We'd get in some flea bag hotel and, you know, with two beds, and we take the mattresses off the bed and four guys and flip a coin to see who had to sleep on the hard box spring or who got the mattress.
That's some tough going there. JJ, for you, 350 days on the road, living like that, driving from match to match, what did that mean for a family life or any kind of leisure time at all for you?
Well, you had to have a special family that understood that this was your passion, and that involved you making sacrifices, but also involved your family making sacrifices in terms of time away from home. And, you know, you're hearing things like with just listening to Ted, that, you know, people think of wrestling as turning on a television and seeing you on TV and right away making the assumption that, oh, you're on TV, that means that you're a huge star and that you're an extremely wealthy man, which was not true. And some people that were in the business took that perception of stardom and the fact that they drove big cars and what have you and lived in big homes, and that there were people who spent every dollar that they ever earned trying to live up to that image, and when it was all over, ended up with nothing. So the business could be very cruel and unforgiving, but at the same time, extremely rewarding. It just it's like, for me, as a 16-year-old kid from New Jersey, I discovered professional wrestling and dreamed that maybe someday, because I used to go to Madison Square Garden and I'd see Argentina Rock and Dr. Jerry Graham and Eddie Graham and all, and Haystacks Calhoun, Chief Big Heart, all these bigger-than-life characters, and someday dreamed that maybe I could step into the ring in Madison Square Garden, which was a reality that came true for me years later. That was the rewarding part of it. And a lot of guys spend every dime that they make trying to live up to what they are perceived to be the image of, well, you're famous and you're rich. And the lucky ones make enough money to have a comfortable lifestyle and are able to save money. But the business can be very rewarding and can be also be very cruel at times.
Yeah, I want to say it's a hard life, but this is not by any means a grim film. Some of the stories, I mean, we hear The Million Dollar Man, Jimmy Superfly Snuka, The Hammer, The Butcher, The Mask, The Wrestling Rabbi. I mean, this is a film about the people behind these played-up personalities and really the shtick. Darren, what did those personas bring to professional wrestling?
Well, wrestling will never be the same, in my opinion, as it was in the 70s and 80s. It just seemed like everybody was truly special. And these guys are real athletes today, don't get me wrong, but everybody I talk to, like whenever I mention the movie, they say, oh, that's when wrestling was wrestling. I mean, I can't even keep track how many times I hear that. And all these guys were really, truly special in their own way. They had their own characters, like Greg Valentine, real serious wrestler. And you have, you know, different people like Wendy, who's a great wrestler as well, and Paul Orndorff. Like, they all have something special. It's just hard to say which one of them is. Every one of them brings something to the table in 350 days. I mean, we have never before seen photographs from around the world. You know, it's just tremendous.
Well, and there's a lot of joy and a lot of payoff. And JJ, you say in the film that celebrity put a lot of temptations in front of you. And for some of the people in the film, that was drugs, steroids for bodybuilding, cocaine and amphetamines and alcohol just to keep going. And women, especially in the South, interestingly enough, one of the wrestlers says, they were readily available. Do you think it was difficult for you to, well, you said in the film, you know, you were married 35 years, not to the same person.
That's the sum total of three failed marriages, of which I'm not, you know, I'm not bragging about. But, you know, my first marriage only lasted 4 years because I was just getting out of college and brash, immature, and not ready for the experience. The only positive thing was I had a daughter from that marriage that I love and care very much about. And my second marriage, I think, was 17 years, and we had no children. She had children by her previous marriage, which I helped raise, and then the third marriage was like was 14 years, and again, I had children. I had twins when I was 50, and another girl came along 3 years later. So, I mean, it's my life is just, you know, unique, I guess, for me, but the story is very similar to other people that had fell in love with professional wrestling and had it be their chosen career. And for me, I was fortunate to always make a decent living, got a chance to go places and travel the world where I would not have otherwise. And so I kind of look at the big picture of, you know, was it a hard life? Yes, when you're working 50 weeks a year away from home, you know, where you're wrestling 7 days a week, you know, your family has to make sacrifices, and you make sacrifices of not being home, missing birthdays, missing anniversaries. But the wrestling business is very demanding. And yet, you know, I look back, I'm 77 years old now, and I spent well over half a century full-time in this business. And I have to say, in all honesty, that I don't regret a moment of it. I wouldn't change anything because, like I say, all the places in the world that I got to go, all the people that I met along the way, and just the camaraderie of other people that also chose the same profession. You know, we're a brotherhood that is very tight as well.
J.J. Dillon there, he's a former pro wrestler, and one of those from the documentary film 350 Days, and that's how many days a year wrestlers often spend on the road. Darren Antola is also with us. He's the creator of the film and the executive producer. So watching the footages of these matches, right, the theatrics, you know, pounding on the canvas, fighting with the refs, you know, executives in suits jumping into the ring and being thrown over the ropes, how much of that is real? Darren, you want to pick that up?
Well, you can't fake gravity, I can tell you that. And you can't wrestle 350 days a year and not get hurt. It's impossible.
But we have learned that the finishers were predetermined. There was a really strict code of keeping these tricks secret. We got the baby face, who's going to win, and then the other guy. But as you said, what happened in the ring was no joke, as we hear in the film.
It's not a desk job. It's a very physical job. Is that wrestling all fake? I go, well, it is orchestrated. But at the same time, it's, man, the getting slammed and thrown through tables and getting hit with steel chairs, we really do that. So the injuries are real.
So it,
yeah, I agree, Ken, because I lived it. And the injuries are real. The blood is real. And, you know, if you have to love this business to do it, because you often sacrifice your body, and you're in the ring with someone who also, like you, for the most part, has a family to feed. So we're going to go at it. You know, I look at like two professional football players that are on the line, and when that ball is snapped, you know, these 250, 300 pounders, you know, just crash into each other with all their might, and that's really what professional wrestling is about. You go out there and you give it all, and you hope at the end of the day that you go home and you haven't got any broken bones or anything that's going to prohibit you from coming back and doing it the next day so that you can feed your family.
Well, you know, so we hear broken noses, blown out knees, fused vertebrae, people covered in blood in photos. As I mentioned, they would cut themselves with a razor blade across the forehead, so blood would just be pouring down, all part of the theater. Now, that was just in the ring. But outside of the ring, fans were apparently pretty brutal, would often want to get into a fight, were sort of gunning to take on the big wrestler. In fact, JJ, you were shot at, weren't you, once in Canada?
I went through the whole gamut. I was shot at. And if you were, it's like you can't get mad at the fans. Sometimes your first instinct is if you had a hot match and some fans came into the ring and the police had to come, and a lot of times you get a police escort out, and you're angry at the moment because the fans, what I call, stepped over a line by coming into your realm in the ring. But you can't really be mad, because this is what if you're good at what you do, the fans sitting there looks at something that's, a performance art, but when it's performed at its highest level, it looks so real that it becomes real. Mm. And that's what where fans, they lose. If someone said to them, well, I'm buying a ticket to go to watch the matches because I really enjoy it, and somebody said, well, you're going to get mad and you're going to get so angry that you're going to do something that you wouldn't think that you'd be capable of doing, which is getting out of your seat, climbing in the ring, and trying to interfere in something. And most people would say, oh, no, I never take it that serious. And yet it happened on a regular basis. And when you're in the ring and if a group of people decide to come in the ring and interfere, you're very, very vulnerable. So forgetting the fans coming in the ring, it's a physical encounter between two individuals, and I don't care how much training you've had, but when you have two guys that are between 250, 300 pounds and some much heavier than that, Andre the Giant was well over 500 pounds, which, again, was the exception, but he was just a big, powerful man. And it just, as I look back, I am so fortunate that I had 3,200 professional matches over a 20-year period of time. But I also got a chance to travel the world, go places that I wouldn't have otherwise.
Darren, forgive me.
Madison Square Garden, dreamed that someday I would hopefully be there, and got to live that dream too. Go to Japan, go to Australia, where I lived for a year and wrestled. So I have nothing but good memories.
JJ, and thank you for that. Sorry to interrupt, but we just have a minute left. And I wanted to ask Darren, I mean, the 70s and 80s, this was a pretty gritty era for wrestling. Now people get drug tested regularly. Are there more protections for wrestlers against these kind of injuries and fans?
Well, yeah, I mean, as the sport evolved, I mean, testing came. Vince McMahon made a lot of test of it, things. There's no more razor blade jobs like that anymore because of the hepatitis. But yeah, absolutely, it's changed for me. It'll never be like it was, and just don't miss out. You can watch it now on iTunes, Amazon, and on demand cable. Please don't miss 350 days. This is going to really be something special to you.
Yeah, Hulk.
And Darren, I was privileged that you included me in that documentary, and it really, I would encourage anyone who's even not even sure that they're a wrestling fan, watch it. It dwells into the lives of top people in the industry, and you hear their personal stories, and I think it's a wonderful documentary.
Yeah, it's a real human story there.
Thank you so much,
thank
JJ,
you both
for being involved. Thank you.
Thank you for being here, JJ Dillon, Darren, and creator behind the new documentary 350 Days. Again, the film is streaming now on iTunes, Amazon, and on demand, and you can check out the trailer at our website, gpbnews.org. Don't forget, today, Political Rewind's going to be wrapping up the heartbeat bill, the bill scheduled to be signed today at 10 o'clock by the governor. We'll, of course, be covering it on GPB, and all things considered, and again, Political Rewind.